Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the roundtable today are Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com.
Morning. Great to be here.
Let's start with the vice presidential debate. J.D. Vance presented a more moderate face to the nation last week. He did do some rhetorical tap dancing on abortion and climate change, but he really didn't take the bait and managed to remind people of his personal story and his blue-collar beginnings. Jeremy, what has the reaction been here in Ohio to Vance's debate performance?
Pretty much about it's been across the nation. This is the vice presidential debate.
Yes.
And while in a race that's close, you know, these kind of debates can matter. I feel that for the most part, it didn't make a lot of long-term changes, especially in a state like Ohio, which is already expected to go for Trump by a wide margin. So I think that in this case, this was a much more even-tempered debate than we saw with Trump's debates with either Kamala Harris or with Joe Biden. And I think a number of people left saying, oh, well, maybe we should have seen a presidential debate that was a lot more like they used to.
Yeah. Megan, this wasn't the combative senator from the TV interviews and the podcast, the ones that's making headlines for his comments about women who don't have children or comments about Springfield. He had that more middle of the road approach.
Right. Yes. He was very cordial, which I think surprised a lot of folks compared to his typical.
They both were to each other.
They were. Yes. They were kind of buddy buddy. They even agreed on some points and showed like empathy and sympathy. Like I remember when Walls was talking about his son witnessing a shooting when he was a teenager, and Vance kind of took a beat, and
he seemed to have a genuine reaction to that.
He did. Yeah. So it was very like cordial, which I think a lot of people didn't quite expect. But there were some moments, such as when he was going at the moderator saying, like, I thought we weren't going to fact check.
Yeah.
So that kind of showed a little more of the advance that we've become accustomed to. But he is a polished speaker because of his TV interviews and appearances. So I think that set him up maybe more than Walls.
You know, Sarah, I saw this Venn diagram circulating during the debate that had two circles. One was people watching the VP debate, and the other was undecided voters, and there was zero overlap. So, I mean, right, that's the question. Does this matter?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, back to tradition in that it was pretty non-consequential. And also, you know, as we've talked about, pretty civil. I think a lot of people who were in the Venn diagram of watching the VP debate, and they're probably a decided voter, commented after the fact about this kind of return to civility. And it was a little boring and a little wonky and a little in the weeds. And maybe that's a good thing. So,
yeah. You know, Jeremy, the one place where it might matter is 2028. Vance's favorability improved 9 points after the debate, according to one CBS poll, and Vance 2028 started trending after the debate ended. So maybe the real outcome for Vance is that this helps set him up for the next presidential election.
Well, one of the whole reasons that people consider that Donald Trump picked J.D. Vance was that he would be Trump's heir apparent, ideally for them, if after Donald Trump serves another 4 years as president.
Right.
But even if he doesn't, that he would be sort of the logical next person to assume the mantle of Trump's legacy and his movement. We'll see what ends up happening with that. But at the very least, they're putting him out there for a reason. And it's to set him up to take over the leadership of this. I think Vance is, you know, he has to kind of do two things at once here. He has to, a vice presidential nominee traditionally is sort of an attack dog who can make the attacks against the other ticket that the presidential candidate can't. But of course, this is Donald Trump, you know, who no one's going to out-attack Donald Trump. And so you're setting him up then to both go after the Democratic ticket, but also kind of be like the good cop of the two.
Yeah.
And so we saw a good cop J.D. Vance. Yeah, we saw a good cop Vance in the
I like that analogy. You know, Jeremy, I think what is going to matter most, though, to Vance's future is whether Trump wins or loses. Because if he loses in November, I wonder if there'll be Monday morning quarterbacking about whether picking an heir apparent instead of somebody who would shore up a weak spot like Mike Pence did was the right call.
I mean, if Trump loses, it's kind of a political vacuum in the Republican Party. And you're right, there could be a backlash against J.D. Vance saying, oh, you know, he was a drag on the ticket or, you know, at best a missed opportunity.
To pick up points.
Because, you know, there's one of two reasons you pick a VP nominee. One is to help you get votes in the current election. Or the other one is to actually become that heir apparent. And J.D. Vance was picked at a time when Biden was, you know, falling, like a dead fall in the polls. Kamala Harris hadn't taken over the nomination yet. And there was kind of a feeling of, oh, Trump kind of has this in the bag. And now if Kamala Harris comes back and actually wins this thing in a way that Biden didn't seem like he was going to be able to, then there'll be sort of, hey, we picked this guy for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. I wonder, though, because I feel like, I mean, and it's so different because obviously Governor Ron DeSantis was running against Trump. But for a period of time, it really was like, who carries the torch when Trump is done? And Trump says he's not going to run in 2028 if he loses. And of course, he would be in his mid to late 80s at that point. So who knows?
Yeah. And he'll be ineligible again if he wins.
Yeah, of course. But it's definitely an interesting question because I think there is this serious question about that vacuum you're talking about, Jeremy. When Trump is truly done with politics, who takes over for this movement that he's commanded so much power among? And it right now, it really does seem like Trump's supporters and Trump's backers, and of course he's the picked vice presidential candidate, but they really do seem to like Vance. He's young, he's well spoken, he really does seem to have that potential that people who were talked about like Governor Ron DeSantis were not really able to command.
So let's talk a little bit about Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. He looked nervous at first, but he did seem to find his footing after the first few questions. I also think they should have done an introduction, Megan, rather than jumping right into foreign policy, but neither here nor there. The moment that drew the most post-debate discussion was when Walz asked Vance who won the 2020 election.
This was a threat to our democracy
in
a way that we
really
had not seen.
A point
and it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
Yeah, so Vance refused to say whether Trump lost. And I think he's kind of, I mean, he's between a rock and a hard place on that one, Megan.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was kind of the defining moment for Walz in the debate. It came at the very, very end, which is memorable in a way because that's the last thing that viewers will kind of take away and remember. But yeah, I think that was probably what Walz was hoping to accomplish by really pressing Vance on that question. And he just kind of danced around it.
Yeah. With less than a month to Election Day, Republicans are continuing to experiment with their messages on abortion. We also saw that during the vice presidential debate. Former First Lady Melania Trump says she supports abortion rights, a position that contradicts her husband. It came in a video message when she's promoting a memoir, saying there's no room for compromise when it comes to this essential right. Jeremy, I don't know, much like a VP debate, whether the former First Lady's opinion on abortion makes a lot of difference here.
Well, Donald Trump's already had to walk this fine line as well on abortion because he's tried to take the ground of, well, I don't want a national abortion ban because it's been proven in many cases around the country that that leads to Republican nominees losing. On the other hand, he says it's really up to states to decide. You know, it's up to states. And if Ohio, like it did last year, decides wants to put abortion rights in the Constitution, that's fine. And if other states, you know, like Indiana, for example, want to put, you know, put anti-abortion language in their law or Constitution, that's fine, too. Well, he's been walking this and then and that already has led to some blowback from the anti-abortion movement,
evangelicals,
which is
said, yeah,
and who are like, what are you doing here? And then meanwhile, Donald Trump is saying, well, I also put two justices on the Supreme Court who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. And So in walks Melania Trump to this. I think this isn't going to cost him a whole lot of votes, though, because, I mean, what are anti-abortion activists to do then if they're so disgusted about Melania Trump's comments? Or they're not going to vote for Kamala Harris.
No.
You know, they're not going to do that. I think it could lead some to stay home. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it will. I think people are this is an election where people are just scared of the other guy or other woman getting into office. And they're going to vote for Donald Trump anyway because they see him as the lesser of two evils, regardless of what his wife says.
I don't know, Jeremy. I do wonder, because I think sometimes we do underestimate that small sliver of people who are truly one-issue voters. I mean, folks like Catholics and evangelicals really do put abortion at the top of their list. And when you look at abortion from how they see the issue, you know, something that I've heard from, you know, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and something that I've heard from anti-abortion Catholics is that is their issue, and they don't, you know, they see it as an evil in this world, and
it's a moral issue, not a political
issue. It's a moral
issue,
and it's not something that you can kind of waver on. So I mean, I don't know how much of an effect that has, but I think the idea that, oh, they're not going to go vote for Kamala Harris, I do think it will push some people. I think there's the chance for it to push some people to stay home.
Yeah, that's probably the bigger challenge.
You think that the outcome would be that they just don't vote at
all? Don't vote. Absolutely.
Yeah, Trump tweeted during the debate that he would not support a federal abortion ban under any circumstance and would, in fact, veto one, which is interesting because that 15-week limit was floating around after the Dobbs decision and as all of these states were voting. Senator J.D. Vance has indicated, even he said something different in the debate, but he's indicated he would support a 15-week ban.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that, yes, while Vance has supported previously a 15-week ban, the exact policy of Trump and Vance on abortion is a little, like, unclear. And basically, it sounds like it'll just leave it up to the states, which, of course, is different than what Harris and Walz are promoting through their policy. And in talking to a policy expert on reproductive rights, basically explaining how Harris and Walz policies around reproductive health would line up more with what Ohio passed last year with Issue 1.
Yeah, I want to play a cut of Senator J.D. Vance from the VP debate trying to thread this needle on abortion.
In the state of Ohio, we had a referendum in 2023, and the people of Ohio voted overwhelmingly, by the way, against my position. And I think that what I learned from that, Nora, is that we've got to do a better job at winning back people's trust. So many young women would love to have families. So many young women also see an unplanned pregnancy as something that's going to destroy their livelihood, destroy their education, destroy their relationships. And we have got to earn people's trust back. And that's why Donald Trump and I are committed to pursuing pro-family policies.
You know, Sarah, I find it so fascinating. This was another line that really made the rounds, is that Republicans need to earn the trust of the American people on this issue.
I don't think it's the first time we've heard J.D. Vance say something like that, though. It was very close to, and I think he mentioned it himself, very close to what he said the night that Issue 1 in 2023, November 2023, because
yes,
you always have to clarify with Issue 1, when the abortion rights amendment passed in Ohio, because, you know, he says, he tweeted something very similar, and, you know, Vance himself is Catholic. That is kind of the Catholic line of thinking, that it's not just about, I feel like I'm really speaking to Catholics this morning, but that it's not just about abortion. It's about other women's issues. And I think he does, you know, I'm sure that some people do resonate with that line of thinking, but we have heard that from Vance before. I don't know that it's a softer side, but it's a side that, you know, we messed up. We didn't campaign on this. We're not campaigning on this issue, right?
Yeah. Speaking of which, Megan, Ohio Right to Life held a state house march last week, and they also had this same idea that converting the hearts and minds of Ohioans is going to be essential. The Center for Christian Virtue president Aaron Baer said, if we want abortion to become illegal, it must first become unthinkable. This recognition of you've got to convince people not to do it rather than outlawing it, because we're voting to make it legal.
Right, exactly. Yes, this is an annual march they do at the State House. It sounds like, I was not there on Friday morning, but from pictures I saw, it sounds like it was a sizable event that I think, yes, this is a group of people who are supporting who are, yes, against abortion is just like growing and becoming much more louder in recent years as this has become a much more politicized issue.
Let's move on to the U.S. Senate race between Democratic incumbent Sherrod Brown and Republican challenger Bernie Moreno. Jeremy, it's neck and neck, which we always kind of expected it would be. The polls are tightening. An October 3rd poll by 538 shows Brown leading by about 2 percentage points. That's within the margin of error. So it's going to be a close call, I think. And we kind of always knew it was going to tighten that way.
Yeah, the race has kind of unfolded the way most people would have expected it to, which is to say there's a lot of unknowns. I mean, we can nail down now what some factors will be to look at on election night about how this will go. One factor will be how Northeast Ohio will turn out, both in terms of minority voters in the Cleveland area and in terms of white blue-collar voters in areas like Mahoning County, and Lorain, areas like that. And obviously Sherrod Brown needs to get a big turnout in Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati, but he also needs to win, which is something that Democrats are increasingly unable to do, win those blue-collar white voters in Northeast Ohio. And then they also need to cut their margins in Republican, more rural areas.
He needs to lose by less.
Lose by less. So, I mean, you don't have to, it's not always a win or lose thing in politics. You just need to cut your margins. Like when you look at 2012, when Obama won Ohio, he would lose these smaller rural counties by, say, like 60-40. And then now you look at Donald Trump and he's winning them like 80-20. And
yeah.
If the Democrats can just cut that down, that adds up, because there's 88 counties, of course, in Ohio. And that leads to a real vote total there. And that's what Sherrod Brown has to do. Bernie Moreno, meanwhile, has done a fine job. He hasn't had many unforced or forced errors in the campaign. Both are going on their bus tours now, and we'll see how it goes.
Tis the season for bus tours. I will say, Sarah, what I was surprised by, so as soon as that audio came out of Moreno saying women over 50, like, don't have a dog in the fight when it comes to reproductive rights, it was within 24 hours, there was ads up on my television.
Absolutely. And I think if you compare it to a lot of the ads you've seen out of the Brown campaign, they're certainly campaigning on abortion because Democrats feel like this is an issue they can win on among other Democrats in the state and among women. But a lot of the campaign has been focused on, I would say, labor and union support and those blue collar workers that Jeremy's talking about. So I don't think all of the ads have been about abortion,
no.
But they have certainly been hitting him on this video. And as someone who's been covering Moreno for the last couple of months, he definitely has this like sarcastic edge to him at campaign events. And I'm not condoning the comments. I'm not making any commentary on the comments.
Yeah.
But I think that is the one potential for errors on the campaign trail that might hurt him one way or another, that I think Brown, who is a seasoned, polished politician, doesn't as often step in something like that.
Yeah, I think he's looking at the results from November 2023's issue one, where Butler County, very red county in southern Ohio, voted for reproductive rights very narrowly. So I think he's trying to appeal to those voters with that ad, probably.
Absolutely.
Coming up, one lawmaker wants to mandate panic buttons for school staff in the aftermath of a fatal shooting in Georgia. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we get you all caught up on all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with me is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Former President Donald Trump says he would remove the temporary protected status for Haitian migrants living in Springfield and deport them. Asked in an interview what would happen if Haiti wouldn't take them back, Trump simply replied, "They will." So, Jeremy, TPS is a program that can put people on a path to a green card. And I'm unclear. We probably don't know how many Haitians living in Springfield already have green cards versus who are still on TPS. But I should at least say that the green card holders would not be deportable in this situation.
That's correct. This is perhaps not surprising. When there's one of the main reasons that the whole issue of Springfield got play. And if you look at conservatives, many conservatives say that it was Donald Trump and J.D. Vance bringing this to America's attention. Whether or not you believe the unfounded rumors about dogs and cats is that it brought attention to the actual idea of, hey, there's these Haitian migrants, these Haitian immigrants in Springfield, and they're putting a strain on the safety and social safety net in terms of health clinics, and there was that well-documented bus crash. And we can talk about the actual effect of that and how much this has been whipped up. But at the same time, Donald Trump is never one to not double down. He's never like, oh, sorry, my bad. I didn't mean to make this attack. I'm going to step back. You know, Donald Trump, like him or not like him, is going to double down on what he's saying. And this is another similar in the vein of, we'll build a wall in Mexico, we'll pay for it. It says, oh, well, we'll just send him back to Haiti.
Yeah, I will say he did try to remove TPS status during his first term as president. There was a lawsuit because they have the right to challenge the removal. It got tangled up in court. And then by the time it moved forward, President Biden was the president. He ended it. So it's entirely possible that he could begin that process all over again. It could get all tangled up in the court again. And then it would be up to whoever follows him out of office in 2028. So who knows? But while we're on the topic of Springfield, Governor Mike DeWine has set a mobile health clinic there. He said the 2-month wait for health services is unacceptable. So that is just to say, Megan, there are real problems that they are facing from the influx of migrants, one of which is wait times for healthcare. But DeWine has set a mobile health clinic.
Yes, yes. And there have been, as Jeremy was kind of alluding to, like a strain on some of the resources in the city, such as healthcare, and the schools have seen just a huge influx. And so I think that this is an example of something that they're trying to do to help kind of alleviate some of those things and try to just give more resources to the community. And going off of what Jeremy was saying earlier, you know, if theoretically those Haitians were to be sent back to Haiti, I mean, practically speaking, that would be a huge, there'd be lots of issues practically in Springfield with jobs and those who employ a lot of Haitians. And so that could lead to just a whole other slew of issues for Springfield.
And one more quick thing while we're on the topic of Springfield. Sarah, one of your colleagues posted an arrest report from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. The report says a white man in his 50s got off a riding mower and shot 2 geese at Rocky Lakes Golf Course. So perhaps this is where the geese rumors start, but it was a white guy in his 50s.
Yeah, I mean, you saw a lot of jokes from people of both parties in the aftermath of these rumors about, well, oh, these, and I don't like to, I'm not making these jokes. I'm just saying
yes.
What people, but something along the lines of, oh, tell these Haitians to come to my golf course. So when you see an actual report like that, and it kind of speaks to, this is something that happened. This man is decidedly probably not Haitian, but he did kill some geese. It just all kind of feeds into the spotlight that this is on this town and is on this area, that every little thing, I mean, even kind of diverging a little bit, but like, I've seen instances of state lawmakers share pictures of car accidents in Springfield.
I've seen
and
a
then
lot of those.
It turns out that the 2 women driving the cars were white, and I believe they were both Ohio residents who had not immigrated here. So like, car accidents happen all the time, but unfortunately even these minor incidents that the news would generally not report on is suddenly becoming something that blows up on social media because there's just this continued spotlight on the region.
So today is the very last day to register to vote for the November 2024 election. It is also the very last day to update your registration. That's probably, if you are registered but you've moved in the last couple of years, you definitely should check and make sure you're going to the correct polling place. But Jeremy, the Ohio Democratic Party is suing to block a rule requiring those dropping off ballots for others with disabilities, which you can do, you can bring it there, would need to come in and sign a form. Secretary of State says the suit was filed too late and early voting is starting tomorrow. Is it too late to change this rule?
We'll find out.
That'll be confusing, though.
Like, it'll be very confusing.
You have to sign the note for a week and then you don't for the rest of, I don't know.
This seems to be just kind of every election season. There's this very late breaking lawsuit that throws, you know, a lot of doubt into the election as it's taking place. This comes out of a federal court ruling back in earlier this summer, where there was a new state law passed, and it said that if it really restricted who could bring in votes to boards of election on behalf of disabled voters. And the state law really restricted it. Under the restriction, for example, someone's grandkid could not bring in an absentee ballot on behalf of a disabled voter. And so this was challenged in court, and the court said, no, this is too unrestrictive. This is too restrictive. We're going to throw it out. And so Frank LaRose, Secretary of State, Republican from suburban Columbus, said, okay, well, I'm going to issue this order, as he's allowed to do, saying, okay, if you you are only allowed to drop off your own absentee ballot at a drop box at a board of election, and if you're bringing it in another one, someone's absentee ballot on their behalf, you have to physically go into the board's offices, and then it's weird because it doesn't say what the penalty is if you don't do that. I don't know how that's enforceable. Like,
yeah, if,
you know, there's these, obviously there's a camera capturing everyone who drops off a ballot, but like, are you going to somehow track down someone who drops off your mom's absentee ballot? I don't understand how that's enforceable. And then you have to sign this affidavit that's presented to you. Again, unclear what happens if you don't, saying that, you know, you're doing it this all legally. Interesting about this lawsuit is already three Ohio Supreme Court justices have recused themselves from this. And they are the three justices who are up for election this year. And, you know, they didn't really say why they're recusing themselves, but the conjecture is that, you know, they're on the ballot themselves, so there would be a conflict to weigh in about who can vote or not vote for them, or weigh in that way.
And just a reminder, if you're not sure about your registration, you can go to vote.ohio.gov. Franklin County, you go to the Board of Elections to vote early. That's at 1700 Morris Road. Also, Sarah, you need a valid ID.
Yes, you do. That's due to a semi-recent state law change, and it's a valid photo ID. Ohio used to require ID at the polls, but you could bring in something like a bill or a paycheck to prove your address. But it is now that you need a valid photo ID. Your passport can count, which passport wasn't one of the accepted IDs before, but you can bring your passport. If you have an Ohio driver's license and it's an outdated address, I believe you can still vote at your registered address. So just make sure you have some form of photo identification. And you do not need photo ID at present to vote by mail. So if you want to vote in Ohio and you do not have the proper photo ID to vote in person, you are still able to legally vote by mail. When I moved from Pennsylvania to Ohio, I had to vote by mail in our first two elections before I finally got my Ohio driver's license, because I was still living with my parents and going to college in Ohio, but living in Pennsylvania permanently. So still can vote without a photo ID by mail.
And I will say that if you forget your ID, you can always come back another day, or you can vote and then come back and show your ID later. So you do have that second option. If you just want to vote, get it out of the way, you can come back, show your ID, and then they'll move from provisional to
actual.
And you have 4 days to do that.
So you got some time.
And I will say the one really quickly, if you're planning on voting early, I learned this. The spokesperson for the Franklin County Board of Elections, Aaron Sellers, told me this late last week. They've gotten more machines and they've expanded their space. So they are going to be able to get more voters in and out the door quickly at the early voting center. So it remains to be seen what those lines are going to look like. Of course, this is going to be a popular election. It's a presidential election. There's a lot on the ballot in Ohio, but the Franklin County Board of Elections says they're going to be moving people in and out the door quicker than they have in years past.
And Jeremy, if you vote for Green Party candidate Jill Stein, it is not going to count.
It's not going to count. And if you get, if you are one of many people who registered to vote absentee, you're going to get a little note in your ballot saying that you can still vote for Jill Stein and Anita Rios, who's her running mate, but it just won't count. And the reason gets really messy. It boils down to that this is, seems to be a continuing theme that Ohio's administrative deadlines for elections this year, the deadlines were before the major parties, or the minor parties in this case, held their national conventions. So the deadline to actually remove yourself or swap someone out on the ballot was in early August, but the Green Party didn't nominate their VP candidate until late August. And when there was apparently some miscommunication or a disconnect, and it led to the Ohio Green Party bringing in a withdrawal letter from Anita Rios, who's the VP candidate for Stein in Ohio, and only Ohio, saying, hey, I'm going to withdraw because we're going to swap in our national VP candidate. Problem is, the deadline had passed. Yeah. So they accepted the withdrawal because that deadline hadn't passed, but it was too late to swap someone in. And because there's no VP on the ballot now, you're not allowed to have any of the votes for you count if you're Jill Stein. So there's now finger pointing about, you know, the Jill Stein's campaign says that this was done without Rios's permission or knowledge. And the Green Party says, no, like she was on the phone the whole time that this was happening. It's just a mess. But the upshot is that if you're one and Jill Stein, you know, no one's predicting that she's going to like make a difference in the election the way Ralph Nader did in Florida in 2000. But tens of thousands of people in Ohio voted for her in 2016. And I guess you still can vote for her this year, since your vote will not count.
Moving on, Sarah, Senator Michelle Reynolds wants to require panic buttons in schools. The bill is known as Alyssa's Law. Do we know why it's named that and what exactly this is proposing other than just handing them out to every district?
I believe it comes in the wake of a recent school shooting in which
Georgia,
these panic buttons were used, and it was found that obviously the law enforcement response is a little bit quicker. But I think it's the law started in New Jersey. It's maybe named after a New Jersey girl. But it I want to say she died in Parkland. I'm sorry. I'm like, do I have the details right? I believe.
Parkland was Florida.
Parkland,
I know sometimes
Florida,
it's hard to keep track.
But of course, the law passed in New Jersey is my understanding. So you've seen these laws pass in some states. And I think it's this question of, you know,
how do you get a response quick?
Absolutely. There have been school shootings. You hear Democrats and Republicans proposing different positions. Of course, you know, Republicans are pretty anti-gun control for the most part. Democrats say that gun control is the answer. But this is something that kind of, I think, both parties could get behind. It seems like a bipartisan solution to improve safety in schools for, of course, if something like a school shooting happens, but if any sort of an emergency happens.
Yeah, the bill would set aside $25 million for the next fiscal year. We'll see if it moves forward in lame duck. That's a conversation for another day. But Jeremy, the Ohio Supreme Court is also taking up a case about guns, about whether state law can legally prohibit people from carrying guns at a bar while drinking.
This is so over the past few years, the Ohio legislature has been chipping away at Ohio's remaining gun control laws, and one of which that is still in the books says, yeah, you cannot go and bring a gun into a bar if you have been drinking. So you can, if you're stone cold sober, you can bring a gun into a bar if they allow it. You know, bars have a right to say no guns. It's their place. But if you've been drinking, you can't. And this is something that the Ohio Supreme Court now will have to decide if this is an law or unconstitutional infringement of Second Amendment rights.
So we'll have to wait and see. They probably won't hear the case till next year.
Probably.
Last but not least, Megan, you reported on a new report that ranks Ohio in the bottom of states with lawmakers who are moms with minor children. That's interesting.
Yes. So this report only looked at moms who have children 18 or younger. And so, of course, there are more moms in the legislature who have adult children. But yeah, it just took an inventory at different states of just seeing how many mom legislators there are when it comes to children who are under 18. And it just kind of showed that, yes, there are not a lot of those moms in Ohio. And the report was just kind of emphasizing, like, because there are less of these moms in the state house, that issues like education and health care and maternal leave are issues that these women can bring to the table. And without having them in office, that can be a voice that's just missing from the table. And also, too, it highlighted the challenges of balancing and juggling the responsibilities of being a mom to a young child and being a lawmaker and just practically speaking, just campaigning and also office, being in office and the demanding hours necessary for such a job.
That was Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to say thank you to Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Thanks, Anna. Always good to be here.
Coming up, Jeremy Pelzer and I are going to do something completely different. We're going to break down the congressional and state house races that you should be watching. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with me for this special election segment is Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. We're going to dive into key legislative and congressional races that are going to appear on the ballot November 5th. Essentially, we're going to tell you what we're watching and why. So we're going to start with Congress. We have three congressional seats that could be close races. All three are held by Democrats at the moment. Let's start with Greg Landsman down in Cincinnati. He's the Democrat who ousted Steve Chabot after many, many years, and he's being challenged by a guy named Orlando Sanzo.
So first of all, to give the overlay, there's 15 congressional districts in Ohio. And as you said, all but three of them are really, it's preordained based on the number of Democrats and Republicans in the district who holds them. And so there's three races that are being watched. Maybe if we're ranking them, like 1, 2, 3 from competitive to least competitive, number three would be Landsman. He's expected to win re-election because it was, the districts were redrawn. And they were redrawn recently, and they were redrawn in a way that turned the district from being kind of a true toss-up or slightly Republican to more Democrat, and that helps Greg Landsman. And Sanza is an up-and-comer within the Hamilton County Republicans.
He ran for a state Senate seat in 2022 and lost, but that was a very long-shot race.
It was a long-shot race, and this is an uphill battle for him as well. I think he has a future within the party regardless of what happens, but it seems it's going to be it's an uphill battle for him regardless. And Landsman hasn't really done, you know, he hasn't made a lot of errors. He hasn't done a lot of things that would really give Sanza a ground to make up that gap.
Next up, as we move towards increasingly competitive, is Ohio's longest-serving state representative, Marcy Kaptur, Democrat, Toledo area. She's being challenged by Republican Derek Marin. And there was a lot of back and forth on who was going to challenge her this cycle. He didn't get in until, like, the very last minute.
Yeah, it was a soap opera, the Republican part of this. Originally, the heir apparent was going to be a guy named Craig Riedel, former state rep. Then he dared to go on a radio show and said he wasn't too fond of Donald Trump, and that basically led national Republicans to pull all their endorsements and money. Meanwhile, hovering over the race was the 2022 Republican nominee, J.R. Majewski, who many Republicans thought took a very winnable race, and that they thought he wasn't a great candidate, and for various reasons,
he had some questions about his military service. There was a whole, like, they thought it they could take Kaptur, but then she beat Majewski in a district Donald Trump won.
And so there's a lot going on here. And into this steps Derek Marin, a longtime state representative who is actually term limited. And he's, I believe he was a mayor since he was 19 years old.
Yeah.
And so he got all the backing of the national Republicans because, you know, there was a change. Now, Mike Johnson's Speaker of the House, not Kevin McCarthy. All this to say that Marin's now, you know, the Republicans are united behind Marin. But Marcy Kaptur, as you said, has been in Congress for, 30 years?
Something like that,
yeah. Longest serving woman in Congress in any state in any period of history. And she's formidable. The reason she is vulnerable, though, the reason that she is on the map is she represents a district where more than half voters voted for Donald Trump in 2020. And that, I mean, a Democrat holding a Trump won seat immediately, like, puts her up high up on the list. And so she's running very hard. She's a good fundraiser. And a lot of it's going to come out to how much people can turn out in Toledo, these Democratic voters will turn out for, versus how many people will turn out to vote for Trump. Toledo is slowly becoming a more conservative city. It was a longtime Democratic stronghold. It's not as bad as Youngstown for Democrats, but it's moving a little bit more red, so we'll see if she can survive another term.
Yeah, if this were an open seat, I would put it in the Republican camp, but because Marcy Kaptur is running, I think it's a toss-up.
It's a toss-up, and she's going to have all the resources behind her that Democrats can throw at her, because she's a long incumbent. It's a top-tier race, and both of those together mean that she's going to have a lot of money to spend.
Yeah, and for listeners of the Roundtable, if Derek Marin sounds familiar, he was going to be the Ohio House Speaker, and then he lost it when the session started. So if he sounds familiar, that's why.
Yeah, just another chapter in
that's a whole other drama.
Turns. Yeah.
Finally, we have what may be the most competitive race in Ohio for Congress is Amelia Sykes in Akron. Now, this is another district that leans narrowly Republican. It includes Akron, but it goes out into, according to the New York Times, I was looking it up earlier.
Oh, it barely went for Biden, but it's almost a toss-up at this point.
Yeah, and so she represents Akron, but it goes out to the Football Hall of Fame. It includes, like, rural parts of Stark County, and so it will be really interesting. It may be too close to call on election night.
It could be, very easily. I think this race, for whatever reason, has not gotten the publicity that it deserves. I think more has been given towards Marcy Kaptur's race. But it's an interesting race. Amelia Sykes is another former state lawmaker who has from a very well-known Akron political family. She has been a very good fundraiser, and she's running against a Republican named Kevin Coughlin, who's a former state lawmaker himself, but from a little further back. And it's a competitive race. A lot of it's going to come down to it's going to come down to national. You know, people, there's not many people who go in on election day and be like, I'm going to vote for Congress. Oh, yeah. And, president and U.S. Senate, you know, so a lot of it will be determined by factors above their pay grade. But at the same time, Kevin Coughlin's been pushing hard, and along with national Republicans, and because they see Sykes, rightly so, as vulnerable. And, I think right now maybe it tilts Sykes, in my opinion, but that doesn't mean by election day that could be wiped away.
So let's start Let's move on now to the legislative races, the state house races. Let's be clear, though, first that Republicans control the Ohio House and they control the Ohio Senate. And come November 7th, they will still probably control the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate. But there are some races that could go either way. One of the interesting things here in central Ohio is we could see the elimination of Republican state lawmakers from Franklin County.
We could. Well, we've already seen the elimination of Republicans from just about from all county level races. I think the last Republican was like the county engineer, and he's gone now. And so this has, you know, been the solidification of Democratic control overall for the state. There's only Republicans hold record, like historic supermajorities. So as you said, no one's going to, this isn't about control of the chamber. The main Democratic goal here is to get rid of, to get enough seats that Republicans no longer control two-thirds of the House, which allows Republicans to do things like pass emergency clause bills and things
override vetoes.
And but it's, we're only, I mean, I think if right now Democrats have 32 seats, and if they end up with about 35 seats in the House, I think they'll be pretty happy and call it a pretty good election. And there's not a lot of competitive seats under this current redistricting map. And we're on the cusp of a vote to possibly, if
redraw them all over again,
under a completely different system. And so there's only about a dozen truly competitive state house races and maybe one or two, definitely one, but maybe one or two more state Senate races that are truly competitive. And a couple of them are in Franklin County. As you were, to get back to what you were saying, there's a couple of state house races. One is the only state house race current, or state house seat only held by a Republican right now, is in around Grove City,
south of Columbus,
of Columbus, and it extends up into like Marion Village, part of German Village. David Dobos, the current incumbent Republican, is leaving, and so you're going to have attorney Brian Garvine versus Mark Sigrist, the Democrat in the race, who is a Grove City councilman right now. And this is really going to come down to turnout in Grove City and how much Mark Sigrist can get support there, or Brian Garvine can get support there, and offset the Marion Village, German Village Democratic lean that Sigrist is probably going to get there.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things, you know, we briefly mentioned that Derek Marin was supposed to be House Speaker and then he wasn't House Speaker. This is could be a key vote for the next House Speaker. So if the Republican wins, Brian Garvine, he seems to be leaning towards Senate President Matt Huffman, who will switch chambers. So I suspect Huffman may be invested in getting Brian elected, not only because you keep the numbers up, but that's a vote for him over the current sitting Speaker of the House, who would like to keep that job.
And he's literally invested in Garvine, giving him a lot of money. And that's true with a number of these races that, you know, there's this underlying,
there's a proxy war behind it.
There's this whole proxy war. You know, if there's one thing this conversation has shown, is that there's a lot of drama on every level of Ohio politics that this plays into. One other race to look at, too, is up in like Dublin and northwest Franklin County, where you have Crystal Lett against Stephanie Kunze for a House seat. These two ran for state Senate in 2020, and Kunze won
by
I think like 115, 116 votes or something.
Incredibly close race.
Like very, very close. And now they're running again for an open seat. And it's going to come, it's a Democratic-leaning district, but Kunze is well-known and is a moderate among State House Republicans. So that's kind of a toss-up seat, too. And if, as you were saying, so if the Democrats win both of those, then at least in the House, every House seat in Franklin County will be Democratic.
So Ohio is not a swing state anymore, but there is a swing district around Parma, which is around where the Cleveland.com coverage area. So this district swings back and forth in presidential election years. It is currently held by a Democrat, Representative Sean Brennan. But, you know, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, because it goes Democrat when the Democrat wins the presidency. It goes Republican when Republicans win the presidency. So, you know, as goes Ohio, so goes the nation is not true, but maybe as goes Parma, so goes the nation.
And there's, so to look at a broad scope on this, there's really three Republican incumbents who are in danger. Jim Thomas in Stark County, Bill Romer, who's also in Northeast Ohio, and Andrea White, who's in the Dayton area. But now, as you were saying, there are a number of Democrats who are in trouble, too, or at least have been considered to be in trouble. One is in Parma, where Sean Brennan is in a top-tier potential pickup for the Republicans. Then Dan Troy, who's in Lake County, where Trump won the district. And then you're looking at Joe Miller, who's over in farther west of there. And he is a Democrat who's also, and they're all facing Republicans who are either perennial candidates or local. They're not especially, these aren't based on the strength of the candidates so much as as you're saying, the way the districts are trending, because these are all suburban, mostly white districts, and then they're considered very vulnerable because of the way just national politics are trending.
Yeah, so it's entirely possible that we end up with a map where Republicans pick up seats regardless of what happens with the presidential race.
Correct, yeah. And all politics are local. And, but then, you know, the candidates actually do matter, too. Dan Troy, for example, has been around forever
for a long time in
Lake County, and that'll make a difference, too.
That was Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable every Monday right here on 89.7 NPR News.